Welcome to our latest edition of Charity Pulse, our bi-weekly charity podcast. My name is Charles Mosquito, Charity Director at Quilt Achievement Investment Management. I'm delighted, as always, to be joined by my regular musketeers, Catherine Ross-Jomji, leading charity legal beagle at Shakespeare Martineau, and James Saunders, charity partner at the leading accountancy and audit firm, Moore Kingston Smith. Together, we explore the latest pressing issues affecting the not-for-profit and voluntary sector. Don't forget, you can catch us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and our various websites. We would love to have your feedback, so please send us comments, questions, so that we can cover them in future sessions. Now, Catherine, you and I had a fascinating lunch with Professor Peter Frumpkin, who's the Academic Director at the Gradle Institute of Charities in New College, Oxford. This is a relatively new institute, was set up a couple of years ago to undertake research into all aspects to do with the UK sector. And Peter Frumpkin is from the US and has written a number of books, both on charities and on philanthropy. And we asked him to give his observations, having been here for a couple of years, on the sector. And he came up with seven, I think, issues. One was around cultural austerity. The second one was on marketing and monetizing the sector. The third one was on salaries in UK charities, which were too low. The fourth one was on the lack of investment in infrastructure and capacity building. The fifth one was on marked decline in the willingness to join boards across all age groups. The sixth one was on the UK sector not going down the performance measurement and becoming an industrial complex. So certainly in the US, they were spending eye-watering amounts on that. And then the final one was around the benefits of the sector having greater level of trust and public understanding. Catherine, what were the key bits you took away from the roundtable discussion?
Yeah, so many interesting bits, I think. I thought the culture of austerity was interesting because it was austerity / pessimism and how people react to that and whether that gives them the opportunity to say it's terrible, we can't change anything, therefore we won't try to. But it did also make me think of an expression my mum uses, which nobody likes the smell of singeing martyr. I think the charity sector sometimes is deliberately, we don't spend anything on staff development, we spend the minimum on this, the minimum on that. And it was an interesting challenge to say, is that a good thing? Or would it be better to spend more to be more effective? And I'd prefer the emphasis on effectiveness rather than, you know, how much you're spending necessarily. There were some other great discussions in there, interesting about, you know, paying the market rate for staff and, you know, the market being not just the charity sector. Query whether the Charity Commission do or don't dislike high salaries and what they mean by high and do they mean excessive, and the role of the Charity Commission as the regulator and trust and confidence in charities. Lots of interesting discussions around that. And also this decline in the willingness to join boards. The comparison was given about baby boomers versus Gen X, but actually a few of the people around the table were Gen X and also on boards of many charities. And I think there was a pushback or a challenge about, is there anything here of the greater regulation of charities, that it's now much more time consuming, there's more frequency of meetings, subcommittees, it's much more involved than it has been in previous years. And was there any element of that having an effect on why numbers might be down on people volunteering as trustees?
James, I know you weren't at the meeting, but I sent you the executive summary. So
it needs to give someone. I'll work backwards through Catherine's points, actually. So the question of the fundraiser, if you like, versus charity governor, if you like, is a key one. And the wider point here, I think, is I do appreciate that Professor Frumpkin was talking about insights and he wasn't trying to compare US with UK, but I would imagine a lot of his insights come from that sort of direction. A lot of it stems from the different structures of the respective charity sectors. So the board in America, in the big charities, which are often religious and education organisations, are something very close to half of money raised in America goes to education and religious charities. And of course, that comes from the UK having a welfare state and the US not. There are some massive core differences here. But just looking at that, if you are appointed to a board of one of these very large US charities, you're being appointed as a fundraiser. You know, you're being appointed as someone who is going to give and find other people to give to that charity. In the UK, our trustees are more and more governors of the organisation, you know, really responsible for the organisation. Okay, you could delegate to management, but the responsibilities and the risks associated with trusteeship in the UK are ever increasing. And that I think, is a real core difference between, you know, trying to get people into charity trusteeship and not. Moving backwards through what Catherine was saying, but where does the pressure stem from on charity heads on things like salaries? It's public perception. And again, it's this element of public money. The UK charities are using public money. It's not quite the same in America. It's not public money. It's private, philanthropic, given money. But where there is public money, there is media scrutiny. And that's one of the big reasons, I think, that salaries are low. Why on earth should so-and-so be paid when this charity is doing that? And it permeates into other areas of scrutiny of the charity sector. So there's some big differences there.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, I mean, we've talked about this on previous sessions that we've had on this, but the pay thing, I think that to me is all around messaging. I don't think we should be worrying about what the press has to say. I know people do, but actually it's what we should be comparing it against. And unfortunately, if you're underpaying people, you won't sustain talent.
Again, Charles, go back. Why are we underpaying people? What's the reason for?
Well, because I mean, what happens is, one, we publish it in the report and account, so it's very visible of what salaries are.
FTSE 100 companies are all publishing accounts, and they don't.
Yeah, but if you look at what the CEO of a top 100 PLC, it's 2.5 million, where the average salary in the sector of a CEO is 70,000 or something. So I mean, there's a very big difference there. But actually, private companies, PLCs, don't actually publish all the detail. And it goes back to his original comment, was about, we focus on efficiency and low overheads, and we have this huge austerity. And what we're not necessarily focusing on is effectiveness. And the problem is, a lot of this stems from that. And I'll give you a good example. Sorry, we're just doing a chief executive research at the moment, and we're just interviewing the headhunter companies. And the salary range that came through was, they've taken the existing salary and then just given a bottom figure and a top figure. But when I started examining and questioning that, all they're doing is comparing that into the sector. They're not saying, actually, the skill set you need, you might want to recruit from the private sector or from the public sector, and therefore what is a comparable salary. So I have some real issues around that. I thought it was interesting around the willingness of the boards. Again, I'm slightly, if people want to do something, I think they find time. But there was an interesting article I noticed that Volunteering Scotland stated, around Scottish volunteering report, that there had been a decline from 2010 of people volunteering from 31% to 18%. I don't know if you guys had a look at that, but, you know,
I didn't see particularly the Scottish feedback, but it doesn't surprise me in the slightest, and it won't surprise me in the future if there was a decline in trusteeship across the board, for all the reasons I mentioned earlier: more risk, more responsibility, more time spent, absolutely zero, financial reward, and the pressures on trustees are only going to get more. I mean, we've only got to look at the Centre Barley case, that's going on right now. I mean, who'd want to be who'd step into a trustee role on there? And what does that say to budding trustees when something like this hits all the headlines? And this is only the most recent of a number of high profile trustee arguments that have not been able to stay in the boardroom and have spilled out into the press, the media, and the Charity Commission, and investigations, and so on.
So I think the Scotland piece was around volunteers in the traditional sense of volunteers, yeah. i.e. not trustees, which I thought was interesting because, you know, it's also talking about they can't afford travel costs, you know, and again, we have this holier than thou attitude at times in the sector. You can't charge travel because we're a charity. You must come to us and bear all the cost. You know, so I thought some of those points are interesting, again, picking up on some of the comments, excuse me, that have already been raised. But I just think in general, it is that piece, isn't it, around what motivates people, why would they want to? And there was a story in the press today around an employee of a charity that had been dismissed. And essentially, she was being particularly horrible to volunteers at a charity shop who are the lifeblood of this charity. They were in a WhatsApp group, and this whole piece was around how volunteers are treated. And again, I would think the ripple effect would be, yeah, why would I want to volunteer for a charity? They're horrible to me. I wasn't treated well. So you've got to be really careful, haven't you, with that reputational damage.
Well, particularly is it if you're looking to raise money from the public and get donations. I mean, actually, you've mentioned Centre Bali, which I think is we talked about in our last session. And from memory, our criticism was around the Charity Commission saying that they were observing what's going on. Well, they've obviously clearly listened to the podcast because now they've opened a regulatory compliance case. And just a reminder for people who may have missed the story, you've got here Prince Harry and Prince Sesio of Lesotho, who were both patrons, have stepped down. The organisation over the last 5 years had a turnover between 3 and 4 million, so it's not exactly a small organisation. Principal activity is to raise fund and awareness and distribute money for specific charitable purposes supporting orphaned and vulnerable children in Lesotho and elsewhere. But what is more interesting is that we've had 9 trustees resign since the last report and accounts, which was the 31st of August. The CEO has also resigned. Richard Miller seems to be no longer there. And one of the 9 trustees was the Right Honourable Baroness Chalker of Wolsey, who happened to be a minister of the Crown, who served in the Foreign Office. So there's obviously something that's gone on quite significant with the organisation, and it raised a number of questions. I don't know, Catherine, if you want to sort of
I'd seen some commentary on it about founder rights and founder provisions and being quite critical of Prince Harry that he didn't think this through and insert more controls would be summarising what was said, which I thought was completely wrong. Actually, if you try and register a charity today with the Charity Commission and insert founder controls about appointing the majority or all of the board, controls on funding, controls on who can be a trustee, you wouldn't get that charity registered because it's not sufficiently independent. And I think that is right. I was surprised, though, I had a little bit of a nosy at the Articles of Association of Centre Bale, and they were more simple than I would have expected them to be. The patrons are appointed by the trustees. So you think, well, game over then, because if you don't like it, you're out. And I did wonder about all these trustees stepping down, who's left to appoint anybody. And it is, well, whoever is left, the trustees appoint themselves. So there is one left, and that only that person, all they can do is appoint further trustees. So it really seemed like an own goal that everybody stepped down. Because then I think, well, then you've just handed it over to the very person you're complaining about, and you haven't got any constitutional powers now.
But the issue here, and I don't have the inside track here, but the chair was appointed on the 25th of March, 13th of July, 2023. She's a corporate lawyer. And according to the press, the trustees, the board asked her to step down and she refused. So what I suspect has happened is that they've said, actually, we're volunteers. We're not getting into a legal fight. We're not going to spend our money doing it. And the easiest thing is to resign. Because the other thing I think comes out is the 4 or 5 new trustees that have been all appointed on the 25th of March, 2025, who's actually appointed them? And how independent is that? I mean, no doubt the commission will come to a conclusion on that when it does its investigation. But I also wonder, James, what messages do you think from a trustee's point of view, do you think that you should be thinking about, not necessarily particularly for this case, but some things that as trustees one might have a look at your own organisations that you're involved with?
I mean, I can only go back to, I think, a point I mentioned earlier, which is that dispute resolution at trustee board. It seems to be extremely difficult to manage at the moment, and something that trustee boards aren't very good at, whether that is in, you know, any sort of formation documents. I don't know. It should certainly be in some sort of memorandum for trustee boards. But as I said, we're seeing an awful lot of these trustee boards come to major disagreements and not being able to find a resolution other than it, where there are high profile charities, fight it out in the media, which is crazy. And you wonder how many more of this is going on that obviously aren't media worthy, if you like, where disagreements can't be settled amicably. I mean, Charles, you mentioned earlier, you know, you've found yourself on the wrong side of arguments in the past. But, you know, you just got to agree to disagree in the end and move on. And it seems that where, frankly, where egos are involved, that just doesn't happen, does it? And these charities are suffering. The charities themselves are suffering because their trustees can't put their egos aside and work for the best interests of the charity itself.
What about you, Catherine?
I think exactly that. I think, you know, when you first read it in isolation, you think this is a voluntary position on a board of a charity. And if everybody else there doesn't want you, it takes a special someone, doesn't it, to dig in and say, well, I'm staying and I'm not going anywhere. And I mean, there are rights of removal. You know, the trustees can, in their constitution, remove another trustee. And I do wonder, you see, whether... why wasn't that done? Is it not as clear cut as we're being told it is? But either way, this is just a disaster for the charity. I think we all know of the charity now for all the wrong reasons. And I think that's harder to get away from.
But if the trustees, all of whom resigned at the same time, had written to the Charity Commission saying this was happening, I bet you the response would have come back is, that's very interesting, thank you for informing us, you're responsible for sorting this out and you need to tell us how it's done, it which is not necessarily particularly helpful in these circumstances. And now they've gone into an investigation. The bits to me that I think are very clear is that when you have patrons, you need to have very clear terms of what their roles and responsibilities are. And you probably need a code of conduct in there. I'm sorry to add another piece of paper. And I think also with trustees, because I know two organisations are involved, we do have code of conduct. And if there are disputes, then there is a process that we go through to do it. And the other thing is, and I don't know whether they had it or not, is whether you have terms and succession planning. Because again, the chair had been appointed both trustee and chair at the same time. And so has come in, this whole thing has kicked off. And what, sorry, rather cruelly, looking at her statement in the report and accounts, she said Centre Barley aims to be the model of leadership and capacity building. I'm not sure that is what has happened, but hopefully the Commission's report, when it comes out, will no doubt tell us what that is. The other thing I spotted, you did, James, didn't you, around Instagram's owner Meta and Pinterest have made significant donations to a charity that was set up in the name of 14-year-old Molly Russell, who sadly took her life in 2017 after being exposed to a stream of suicide and self-harm content on the two platforms. What were your thoughts on that one?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's the Molly Rose Foundation, isn't it? And anonymous donations accepted by the charity. It just seemed, you know, perverse on both fronts to me. Why would these organisations give donations to a charity which is fundamentally criticising them constantly and working, you know, to make them change their ways in ways that the organisations clearly don't want to? Why would the trustees really accept the money when it's from the organisations that they are almost set up to criticise? And there is a justification from the trustees that they want to work with the organisations, in which case, why is it all secretive and, you know, under the table, you know, get out on, make it clear what they're all into. I would understand that. Or if they said, look, we're prepared to accept money on the basis that they're all working together. But it seemed the worst of all worlds here to have it secretive, you know, the questions around tainted donations and all that sort of thing. But the whole thing just doesn't seem right the way they've done it.
Catherine?
Yeah, absolutely agree. And I thought they just had such a whiff to it as well of, oh, anonymous donations. You know, well, that didn't work then, did it? And who has breached that anonymity? And where has this come from? And whether people did have issues with, they didn't agree with it being taken in or accepted in the first place. But, you know, others saying, had they deliberately made the donation anonymously in the hope that it would come out and they'd
Yeah.
get some sort of benefit from it
It's
down the
definitely a
line?
Malcolm
So,
Tucker approach, isn't it? It's
yeah.
you know, we'll leak it. No, we'll leak it. No, well, definitely
Yeah.
someone will leak it.
Just not a
Well,
good look all round. Yeah.
so it also ties into or coincides, or if I'm cynical, is about the book that was published, and around well, this is with Meta, isn't it, and their attitude towards this whole issue.
Well, it definitely, it's even more strange, I think, because obviously recently, Mr. Zuckerberg and Meta and Facebook have all reined in their security controls and their fact checking and made it even more of a Wild West than it was before. So for it to be happening in the background, I mean, whether this was these donations were all made before that, I don't know, but in the background and the context of that happening, I would have thought that, that a charity, you know, working to criticize and to reform social platforms on the basis that they're unreliable in reporting facts and leading kids up the wrong path, you know, it would be even more of a, of an odd thing to do to
But
accept.
but funnily enough, I don't have an issue that the trustees accepted the money. I personally, I think I agree with you completely that it shouldn't be done. It shouldn't have been done anonymously or secretively. I would have been, if I was them, I would have been on the front foot and said, "We're accepting this because," which is ultimately what they've done. And but I mean, because we don't know actually how big it could be, quite significant, and it could make quite a difference. And the law, I think Catherine is very supportive of trustees taking that view.
I mean, don't you think it's you know, is there not a similarity to a, an animal rights charity accepting money from farmer who are doing, you know, testing on animals? I mean, there's surely there's a hypocrisy in accepting money from an organisation that you are absolutely, you know, determined to reform, if not bring down.
Well, except that of course for the vets use medication for on animals. So actually, if you've got a farmer that is responsible in the way that
I mean,
they do,
I was being rather crude in the
I know
analogy,
you were, but I'm
but
responding.
surely there is a point at which you say, look, we're, you know, this is one of the major platforms that this organisation is set up to make. We disagree with them on pretty much everything they do, but we'll have their money, even though we
Yeah.
know they're not going to do anything about us.
I took an element of work with them, not, you know, you can't just bury your head in the sand and say it's impossible, therefore we never will. But I just think both all sides could be criticized here to say the way that you went about it was just storing this up as your dirty secret,
Yeah,
whereas you
absolutely. And
need to
that's
get in
Catherine, you're
front of it.
absolutely right. Working with in the future, absolutely great. But as I said earlier, they've just binned all their fact checking. I mean, that's not working with. That's working. That's the, you know, you can be campaigning all you want, but they've gone even worse.
But the issue is not accepting the donation. The issue is the way the donation was made and the secrecy around it. I think that is the thing we need to be very clear. We can agree to disagree on whether they should or should not have accepted it. I would be it would be one of those board things that we would go with the majority, but I would definitely be quite happy to take it as long as we're putting it to good use and it doesn't compromise what you're setting out to do.
Well, I think you'd be in the minority of our board of three, Charles, and now you'd have to go to the media. I'm afraid.
I'm always such a tart. I'd take the money. Might give us the money, but let's
Sorry,
just
you're
stay.
in the minority,
Right,
James.
fine. I'm reading the
There we
Daily Mail
go.
in that case.
All right, and the last thing I had to cover was that the Department of Culture, Media and Sport, DCMS, has asked whether all 21 financial thresholds in charity law should rise with inflation. I have to say, I didn't know there were 21 threshold financial thresholds. James, I'm sure you know all of them. What was
Yeah,
your thoughts on this?
there's quite a few. I mean, there is the absolute big one is the audit threshold, really, because I mean, certainly from my experience, that is where there is a huge amount of extra work for any organisation in being audited and being not audited, and there is a huge discrepancy between what an audit is and what, you know, a small charity actually needs. So that is the one that I would suggest goes up as much as possible, frankly. I know there's a balance between. But you know, an audited entity these days, 10 up to 15 million pounds. they're the thresholds. We're talking about £1 million for a charity, going up to £1.5 million. I think that's very sensible, and I would say perhaps a little bit more, although clearly £2 million, let's say, is still quite a lot of public money to worry about. So I can see why it's low, but you know, £1 million doesn't go a long way these days, to be, you know, to be frank, when it's an organisation. The other ones are relatively minor. Actually, for me, when you get further down the scale, if you like, so something like, you know, £25,000 for an independent examination threshold, I think that should probably stay, because, again, it's public money. An independent exam is an appropriate level of examination for an organisation of that size. It's not massively onerous. It's a good thing to have. So I wouldn't be particularly worried about many of the lower thresholds moving. They're not going to move very much. So, you know, the odd £5,000-£10,000 here on those thresholds that are under, let's say, £100,000, that's, you know, I don't think it's particularly worried, you know, this way or that. But the audit is the big one that really ought to go up.
Yeah, I didn't realise there were so many thresholds, James, and I did see it and think, boring consultation, don't want to read it, James will do it. But I did spot that someone else had helpfully read it and said there was a discussion around the registration threshold, yeah, charity commission. So it's currently £5,000, yeah, and there was a discussion whether it should be increased in line with inflation to get to £10,000. And interestingly, it's not that long ago, the threshold used to be £1,000 and it's been put to £5,000. My query on that is there are many small charities that want a charity number,
yeah,
because it,
yeah,
helps them with fundraising. But also this avoids, well, dodges perhaps, if you're a CIO, there is no threshold because a CIO doesn't have any funds up front, doesn't have to, and can register with zero. So again, I did sort of think that's a little bit smoke and mirrors talking about the workload and whether that would alter it for the charity commission. That will only apply to the other legal structures other than a charitable incorporated organisation. And so I thought that was just a bit interesting of whether that's a level playing field or whether people would like to have a charity number.
So should that be sorted so that actually it's consistent across the various structures?
I don't think it should. I think the CIO at zero is right, because it is, you know, it only exists to be a charity. It only exists under the charity registration and registered by the charity commission. So it's fine if it's going to be registered as a CIO, it's got to have some charitable funds. Yes. By default, it must all be charitable. Whereas a charitable company could alter itself around.
But isn't the way forward that anybody being registered now is going to be a CIO? I mean, you're not going to register under as a company, are you? Otherwise, you have to do.
Some will deliberately choose company because it's a better understood legal structure, and other reasons why company is better for them. And others would say, no, we want to be a charitable trust. We don't want a legal structure. So again, you kind of say, well, that's your choice, but it is a different entry point at the charity commission, whether you've got the 5K threshold or zero. And I think that's a big difference already. So if that were to change to 10K or zero, you know, would that encourage more people to become a CIO? Maybe. But I just thought they were sort of telling half the story there, that that's the registration threshold, when actually it varies already.
And will this also cover the other jurisdictions like Northern Ireland and Scotland? Or is this just purely for England and Wales?
This is purely for England and Wales at the moment, isn't it? But I mean, that, presumably those will be separate consultations.
Yeah.
Well, because we have this ridiculous situation, don't we, with on the audit threshold of in Northern Ireland and Scotland, it's £500,000, and the UK, it's £1 million.
Mm.
So, again, I think some consistency across the jurisdictions, I know the devolvement and everything else, would make a lot of sense. On that note, having had a lively debate on lots of things, thank you, James. Thank you, Catherine. To say that we live in interesting times would once again be an understatement. Thank you for listening. We would love to hear from you. If you have any questions or want us to cover any topics, do please, please get in touch. Do share with family and friends. And according to my mate at Truth Social, this is the only charity podcast worth listening to.